Welcome to the Dive into Reiki podcast. I'm Natalie, and together we will enjoy a series of conversations that explore the journey of Reiki practitioners and teachers from all lineages. 100% Reiki-focused stories, 100% human.
Hi, and welcome to this episode of the podcast. I'm actually revisiting some of the people I interviewed at the first year of the podcast. You already heard the interview with Helen Williams. Today we have Justin Stein and have a couple more surprises for this year, as it is so interesting to revisit people after 3 years and see what has deepened their practice. And in the case of Justin Stein, when we were talking, he was preparing a book that came out at the end of last year. It's a magnificent book. So we're going to be talking about what it takes to do a book like that, that is about the story, the history of Hawaii Otakata, a little bit of all the work he put behind it, but also some of the topics touched in the book. And I wanted first to give you a little bit of his background. Dr. Justin Stein is an instructor in Asian Studies at Kwantlen Polytechnic University. His research program focuses on how exchanges within transnational networks have shaped spiritual and religious practices and ideas in the North Pacific region. His work on Reiki, including original translations of historical materials, has been published in 3 languages. His latest book, Alternate Currents, Reiki Circulation in the 20th Century North Pacific, focuses on the life and work of Hawaii Otakata, whose cultural translation turned Reiki from an obscure Japanese practice into a source of healing and spiritual transformation for thousands of people around the world, if not hundreds of thousands. So a couple of things before you see the interview. Justin, he speaks fluent Japanese, has spent a lot of time in Japan, and he uses a lot of the Japanese terms for Reiki practice. So I'm just going to give you a couple of them. One is Reiju. If you're not familiar with traditional Japanese style Reiki, Reiju stands for attunement or initiation. So when you hear Reiju, that's it. The levels for the trainings are a little bit different in Japanese. They don't call them level 1, level 2, or level 3. It's called, Shoden. Sorry, that was like a blank. So Shoden will be level 1. Okuden will be level 2. And Shinpinden will be level 3. So when you hear Shoden or Okuden, you know we're referring to levels of Reiki training. And then there are words that I mentioned, for example, Joshin Kokio Ho. It's a meditation also called purifying breath in English, in which you inhale into your lower belly, your Hara power center, and exhale that light out. And another one is also Hatsure Ho, which is really about bringing forth your spiritual energy. And it's a series of meditation and techniques put together, starting with Gassho. Sometimes they will recite the poetry of the emperor. You can also recite the precepts. Then you do dry bathing, Joshin Kokyoho, which I just mentioned, and another meditation called Seishin Toitsu. And it's just this whole series is really like almost a spiritual workout. For example, Gendai Reiki, they practice this every day. You can check also an interview with Rika Saruhashi on these. We don't go over Justin's story today, his Reiki journey. I'm going to put on the notes the link towards the previous interview where he tells how he learned Reiki, how he started studying Reiki, and a lot of very interesting also myths that he demystify. And we talk a lot of those are probably the most common in Reiki. In this interview, we go a little bit more depth. We're both getting very excited. I learn a lot, and I feel like from all these interviews, I already learned a lot in the past. I keep learning every day from talking to Justin. So if we get a little bit excited, if you get lost, please leave a comment. I'm happy to clarify anything. Or also, again, Justin publishes a lot. I'm going to put the link for that book. It's a wonderful book. It's very easy to read. At the beginning, perhaps the historical background, you know, you go a little slower, but it really, really is very approachable for regular readers. I'm not a very intellectual reader. I get stuck. I cannot read art critic or very complicated things. This really engaged me and gave me a lot of insights. And what I really appreciate from Justin is he really did it neutral to lineages. This is history. This is very objective. There is no fearing here or there. And as you're going to hear me raving on and on during the interview, he depicted Hawaii Otakata as a human with wonderful qualities and also a human of her times, going through very difficult periods. and sometimes not so wonderful qualities, right? Or decisions that may feel now in hindsight 100 years after, well, not 100, decades after, perhaps like, oh, why did she do that? But, you know, also understanding she is human. So I really appreciate this book. And I'm going to let you go with the interview. Before I leave, please always remember, there is also my Patreon where you can get a lot more information about Reiki practice, gain confidence. You can also support this podcast. The average cost per episode is around $100, $120, which I'm very happy to do. But if you can support the podcast, there is an option for that on the Patreon. It's literally the cost of a coffee a day. And that if you drink like regular great coffee. So check it at patreon.com/diveintoreiki. I'll put that in the notes too. And all the support goes towards editing, towards the storage, towards all the software that makes this possible to happen. So it's very much appreciated, and also hoping it comes back to you 1,000 times. So without further notes, here's my interview with Justin Stein that I'm so grateful he made time for. Hi, Justin, how are you? Thank you so much for coming to the podcast.
Oh, thank you so much for the return invitation. We had such a good time the first time. We had to talk some more.
We did. And I just want to talk about your book. And you have it there. Perfect. Because my copy is already very mangled. And also because I've been carrying it everywhere and underlining. It's called Alternate Currents. And I'm really bad with the title. But I love that you shortened the title. The last time we had, you had a very, very, very long title, and it's now Alternate Currents, Reiki Circulation in the 20th Century North Pacific.
I can thank my wife for that. She told me this title is way too long. And I remember one day I was like walking around thinking, okay, how can we get to the minimum number of words with the maximum amount of information? Like everything that I want to be in there without all the excess, you know, unnecessary words. So, yeah.
One thing I really appreciated, and I read history, but honestly, I have a little bit of ADD, so I need to get engaged to read. Like, I cannot read art critics. I'm like, I'm not. And I took your book, and I'm like, okay, it's going to be a history book. I'm going to like, and I know you're super smart, PhD. I'm like, okay, who? And actually, it was very engaging. I really, really, like, it was a great read for me, beyond everything I learned.
I really appreciate that. Yeah, I tried. I think it depends how much you also are interested in history intrinsically. I think there are some people who are like looking to it for like Hawaii Otakata's story, stories about Usui Sensei, you know, things like that. And then there's like 3 pages about the sugar plantations in Hawaii, which I think is important to really understand where she comes from. And I want to say to those people, like, it's okay to skim, like, and like look ahead and be like, okay, when's the next time we get back to Reiki stuff? Like, if you're not as interested in the historical background and like, you know, you choose your own adventure with the book, you know, it's okay. Cause I think some people, they really want to read every word, every page, but then they're not so interested in the Meiji Restoration or whatever, and then they get stuck. And so I just want to tell anyone listening, if you have the book, if you're really trying to do, you know, every single page, but you're having a little bit of a hard time, just it's okay to skip a page or two and like just find the next part that like calls out to you.
It's funny.
But I'm glad that for your experience, though, that like you found it gripping and compelling and I love that.
I like history, but for me, when I like Reiki history, when it helps me understand the system better. Right. If I start understanding all of Meiji Japan and I get lost.
Yeah.
What I found with your book, and I'm going to ask you some questions before because of that as well. But I understood Hawaii Otakata as a human being. And then therefore I understood the whole Reiki went from her to what she passed in and how it changed as she practiced. Because it was history, but it's like, oh, that's why she stopped doing this. Oh, it wasn't just because she felt like it. Mm-hmm. Like, so there was a reason. So it really helped me understand the Reiki system a lot better. Yeah. I think you painted a picture that is great. And the other thing I felt is like, this is not language, like lineage, like you don't favor any lineage. This is just history. This is the way it is. Like, it's factual, it's engaging, and it's very human, and I loved it.
Thank you so much. That's like exactly what I was going for. So it makes me so happy to hear you Say that.
You did it very well. So I wanted to start with the background because I think people think writing a book is, you know, you just sit in your computer, blah, 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 and you have some information.
Page one, you know.
There was a woman born in Hawaii. Yeah, something like that. But and obviously, if you're writing like a romance novel or something very light, some people have the talent to do that. In your case, though, I wanted you to tell me a little bit how many years, months, weeks, how many boxes. Just give me an idea so people understand that this book, you know, it's not even that big reading it. It's like it has how much work it was behind that.
I mean, yeah, I think from the first draft of chapter one to the book coming out was over 10 years. It was probably about 11 years. And it went through a lot of revisions and, yeah, I did. I mean, I was adding stuff until like the last day I sent it out, you know, at the same time, like the general structure of the book is very similar to the dissertation. So if anybody read the dissertation, the chapters are the same structure. I moved some things around. I took out some of the parts that were really just for other scholars because the book, I wanted it to be contribute to scholarship and contribute to the Reiki community. And so I tried to make it more readable, more accessible. There were some things that had been in the text. I moved it to an endnote. Some things that had been in an endnote, I moved it to the text, you know. And also the other thing, you know, being a scholarly book on a university press, it goes through peer review, right? And so during my PhD program, you know, I had my supervisor, I had people on my committee, I had maybe friends who I shared chapters or the manuscript with who gave me feedback. I had the people from the Reiki community. Susan Mitchell gave me a lot of feedback. Yo-Yan Yonker, I think, gave me some feedback. Robert Fustin, I think, you know, so like all these different people were kind of telling me their thoughts about it. I revised, I you know, I changed. And then, you know, I submit the manuscript to the university press and they go, it goes through anonymous review, right? And so I got like reports, like I think probably two, like six page reports on the book by professors, you know, by scholars who know not necessarily about Reiki, but about related fields. One, I kind of know who they are now. It's supposed to be anonymous, but I kind of found out. One of them is a professor of Japanese religion. One of them is a professor about Japanese American history and Japanese American religious history. And so they were able to comment on, you know, various aspects of the book and push me to like, okay, you know, you make this claim, but there's not enough evidence, or, you know, oh, I think this argument's maybe a little weak, or, you talk about this thing, and there's this amazing example that you didn't talk about, you know, how about citing this literature, or, you know, so how about you engage more with Native Hawaiian history, you know, you're talking about Hawaii, and so getting feedback like that, I think really also improved the final.
Yeah, book. And it was incredible, like, to also know about that Hawaiian history and you know, the role of Niseis and all of that. But I also know that you went through a lot of Hawaii Takata's paper, like, you know, like, how many boxes? Because I think you went through a lot, right?
Yeah, I mean, we started off with some boxes and then we reorganized it. We put it back in the boxes, but then it went to the archive and then they reorganized it in the boxes. So if you go to the University of California, Santa Barbara, where the materials ended up, I think you can look at the finding aid online. I think it's about 20 boxes or something like that. And then in the boxes, there are binders, you know, we organize the materials. Went through everything basically. And we kept everything. I mean, there were things in there like her golf trophies or like her, you know, materials from like her sister's funeral or something like that. And it was like, should this go in the archives? And it's like, let's put it all in the archives. You know, you never know what's gonna touch somebody, you know, and like when you go there, right? The letters, the photographs, like her certificates. Those things are like very powerful and meaningful, and you could spend days, you know, going through it. But the other things, like the things like her golf trophy or whatever, I think there's something, like you said, that makes her like a real human being, you know, and like it's, and I feel like myself, and I'm sure other people feel like this. I mean, like she's almost like our grandmother in a way. And I write about this in the book a little bit, like looking, because I spent so much time you know, reading about, thinking about, you know, talking about these people and this history, and you start to feel this like, well, they always, you know the term like parasocial relationships, where like people like feel like a celebrity is like their friend. I feel like in Reiki, especially with Reiki, because we have like lineage, right? I feel like they're my family in some way, even though, you know, I guess if you go back in my initiation history, my first initiations were Takata lineage Reiki.
Mine too. And
she would be my great, 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 great grandmother or something in the initiation, right? So you do feel this like family connection almost. And so going through the boxes, holding this stuff, it's like going through your grandmother's closet. And then the other thing is that I was doing it with Phyllis Furumoto, who is literally her granddaughter, right? And so hearing her kind of switching between saying, oh yes, my grandmother would do this, but then it's also her Reiki master, right? And so Hawaii Takata used to say, right? And hearing that switching between kind of the kinship, like blood lineage, and then the energetic lineage. And I think trying to balance both of those, right? As the granddaughter and the lineage bearer, you know, getting to spend that time with Phyllis and see how she tried to juggle or balance those different roles. It was very special. And I think I could have maybe done a little bit more of that in the book. I think at some point I need to write another article. I took a lot of field notes, like hanging out with Phyllis and Paul Mitchell and Susan Mitchell and Robert Fuston and Joyce Winnow, Phyllis's partner. And I took a lot of field notes, and I didn't use so much of that in the book, but I do think there's more to kind of think about some of these issues, maybe in future publications.
That's actually a lovely different book, because it's about like after her, you know, the people who came and these people who are close, and your field notes are actually kind of a book about a book, which is very meta and kind of very cool. Good. Yeah. You have to write more books, because we really enjoyed this one.
Thank you.
And I love your premise as well, right? Because, and I think we talked that last time we talked, it's like how people say like, we want to be more Japanese than the Japanese, which I also see martial arts here in New York. And then other people like make it totally the other extreme, right? Very new age. You will not even recognize. Like Mika also will say, what is that? I don't even know what you're doing, right?
Yep.
So I wanted to start before we go into Hawaii. Most of my questions are about Hawaii. But I was reading your book, and I have trouble with his name. This person, well, William Walker Atkinson, but he wrote about a yogi, Rama Charaka.
Yes.
So I was very, because a lot of people say, oh, like the precepts are like affirmation. Then we go, no, they're meditation tools. But tell me a little bit about the new thought school influence on Mika Usui. That part that, yes, obviously a lot of his teachings are anchored in Buddhism, and like we can see it everywhere.
Yeah.
But this is the part that actually also came and, you know, has that first alternate current, as you will call it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's like going back and forth between, I use the alternate current for a number of things. But one thing, for example, like the way that electrical current, right, usually it primarily flows from the generator or the power plant to the end user. But AC like has this like little bit of like reversal as well, right? And so I give this other example of like a teacher primarily is teaching their students, but they're also learning from their students, and the way they teach is influenced by this. And so there's this kind of predominant direction of transmission, but then there's also this like reversal as well, and this like mutual bi-directional or multi-directional influence. But yeah, this other thing about Reiki, again, like starts in Japan and comes to America, but right, Japan in the 1920s has a lot of American stuff going on there. And so in Usui Mikao's like world, in his milieu, in his influences, right, there are these things developed in the US, translated into Japanese, adapted for local settings in Japan, that he, I think, was integrating into his practice. And so you mentioned the name William Walker Atkinson, wrote under many pen names, including Yogi. I think it's Rama Charaka. I'm not entirely sure myself, actually. But he wrote these very influential books around the turn of the 20th century, including The Science of Psychic Healing, the Hindu science of breath, and was teaching breathing techniques, visualization techniques, laying on of hands techniques, and several techniques from his books seemed to have, which were translated into Japanese in the 1910s, seemed to have gone directly into Usui Reiki Ryoho. The clearest one, I mean, there's some things that are very general, using hands to heal.
Yeah.
People around the world do this. But the Ketsueki Kokanho, the what Hawaii Otakata would call the finishing stroke or the Reiki finish, but the in Japanese, right, the blood exchange method, which I know, you know, non-Takata lineages have a bit of a different and more elaborate procedure than what Takata taught. And if you look at what Atkinson writes about in the science of psychic healing, it's like the same. And he calls it, he calls it something about blood circulation, which is what the Japanese name for it is as well. And it's about stroking the parasympathetic nerves alongside the spine, and that's going to get the blood circulating with the prana. And, you know, it's like a way to finish your pranic healing treatment, right? And so, I mean, that's one where it's like so close, it's like hard to miss. And then also Hatsudeho, right? And the meditation method where, you know, this is something that Takata took out, you know, but in the earlier forms of Reiki, where you are doing this meditation, where you're visualizing, you know, maybe white light streaming in through your crown, down to your lower abdomen on an inhalation, and then on the exhalation, returning it to the universe, expanding it out. It's in Atkinson's book. He calls it the prana distributing meditation. And so he has it as your solar plexus, not the lower abdomen.
Okay.
It's a little higher, but the Japanese, right? That's an example of the adaptation for Japanese audiences, right? That, you know, and Atkinson, he's not just New Thought. He's also influenced by yoga. He's influenced by medical hypnosis. He's influenced by, you know, all of these different schools and integrating them. And then Usui taking elements of that and integrating it. And not just Usui, but there were other, I write about this a little bit. And he, Naoko Hirano has also written about this before, about there were other therapists at the same time who were doing very similar practices, and they called it prana therapy. One calls it Reiki therapy. And so, yeah, it's that there's a number of those things. But if I could say one more thing about the New Thought.
As much as you want.
Okay, well, the New Thought question, actually, there's a lot to say. I have a new kind of book chapter that I'm going to be working on specifically on that question, because I got asked to do a talk on it last year, 2 years ago, a year and a half ago now. And so I prepared some materials. I'm like, oh, actually, there's a lot to say about this stuff. And I was doing more research and there's some really interesting things. So I'll say this one thing first and then I'll go to the Gokai. So in Tomita Kaiji's book about Hatsudeho, when he talks about Hatsudeho, he says, basically, you know, you do the meditation along with the recitation of the Gyosei, right? The Meiji Emperor's poetry. Yeah. And the reason you do it with the Gyosei is because the point of Hatsudeho is to correct your kokoro.
Oh, right? That's beautiful.
And Usui Sensei also writes about that.
His heart mind.
The heart mind. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Yeah. The heart mind. So you're trying to correct your heart mind. And Usui Sensei also writes about that in the Kokai Denju Setsume, the kind of explanation of teaching. He says the point of Usui Reiki Ryoho is to basically correct your heart mind, your kokoro, and make your kokoro like the kokoro of a kami or a Buddha. And if you have the kokoro of a kami or a Buddha, you will be happy and healthy. And so the mind or the heart comes first and the body follows, right? This is all in the Kokai Denju Setsume. And so there's this idea, right? Fix your mind or fix your heart, and then you'll be healthy, you'll be happy, And you'll be able to do Reiki for other people. And so what Tomita clarifies, and he studied Usui Reiki Ryoho, you know, in the time of Usui Sensei's lifetime. And what he clarifies is that doing Hatsudeho corrects, you know, in his words, corrects your heart mind, because it merges your heart mind, or it illuminates, that's the word he uses, it illuminates your heart mind with the heart mind of the Meiji Emperor. And so, who is a god, right?
He's passed away.
He's a kami. And in New Thought and Christian Science, right, they talk about the mind of the universe, the divine mind, right? The universal mind. And that in New Thought, they might talk about the universal mind or the divine mind. In Christian Science, it's the mind of God, right? It's the divine mind or the mind of God. And that in doing visualization practice, affirmation practice, you're correcting your mind by, in a sense, illuminating it with the mind of the universe, right? The mind of the universe is perfect. The mind of God is perfect. Our minds are clouded, are delusional, right? And it's through that interaction, right, that kind of influx of perfect mind from the universe that we can correct our own minds, and then we can be healthy and happy and whatever, right? That's like classic New Thought. Now, but there's also a very similar narrative in esoteric Buddhism, in Mikyo, where there's this merging of the practitioner and the Buddha, whether it's Dainichi Nyorai or Amida Butsu, but that the practitioner kind of becomes one with the Buddha. So there's like non-dual aspect. And also in some Shinto thought and maybe martial arts or other things, right? That where there's this kind of emptying out of the self to receive the kind of divinity through you. And so I think it's like one of these really interesting like resonances between native traditions in Japan or traditions received from China, right? I mean, maybe from India through China to Japan. And then also things that were being developed in 19th century, early 20th century America, and that Usui Sensei, maybe, I don't know, of course, we'll never know, but he definitely knew about these different things and kind of combining them and picking aspects of different practices and saying like, okay, this is like a modern effective practice that uses ancient wisdom, right? It draws on ancient wisdom, but it makes it accessible and approachable and adapted for modern audiences and suitable for modern times. And yeah, I think it does like, I mean, it's kind of a cliche, but like combine East and West in some way, and ancient and modern. And yeah, I think the Gokai is one last thing. I don't know if you want to ask any questions about what I just said, but I could just say one last thing.
No. I just, it's funny. I was even thinking like, and we're going to go to Gokai in a second, but like even the fact that he wanted to simplify practices that were only accessible to probably very educated people, is already a symbol of modernization that came from actually opening to the US, right? It's more of a concept of, so even this idea of like, I'm going to take these practices that were reserved for a few.
Yeah.
Obviously, Meiji is the first modern emperor who actually cares about people. And this came from Rika Saruhashi, that she says, like, you don't understand. An emperor worry about his people is very different. Mm. Even that wave of being a little bit more democratic in terms of knowledge is actually the influence from the outside, right?
And you do see that a lot in Meiji period movement. Yeah. For example, Zazen, right? That like before, lay people never practiced Zazen. It was a thing for the monks. And but then in the modern period, they begin to have lay meditation practice. Lay people just practicing Zazen, Zen meditation to improve their lives, to be, you know, better, you know, insight into themselves, into, you know, how to be a better person, how to gain wisdom and awaken, right? I mean, and so that was definitely, but it does start a little before Meiji, at least. That I think in the end of the Tokugawa period, there's a movement called Shingaku, which is basically gaku is study and shin is kokoro. So it's like the heart-mind learning is a way.
Beautiful.
And there are some kind of connections where it's like they're taking kind of esoteric practice in a way and making it very accessible. And it's also another maybe relationship. I want to look more into this because I got a very good question. I gave a talk last year and someone asked a question about this. There's a kind of Neo-Confucian teaching that Shingaku is based off of. And it's basically that like the heart mind is the most important thing and like the only thing in a sense that like the more dominant form of Confucianism is more dual. And this form of Confucianism is more like monistic and yeah. all about the heart mind. And someone asked, could that form, that strain of Confucianism maybe also have influenced Usui? And it's like, it's actually something I had thought about before. And I think I like looked into it a little bit and I didn't find a whole lot. And I just kind of like left it. And I never really returned to that question. So that's also something I'm going to try to look a little more into this year is called Oyome or like Wang Yangming style Confucianism. But yeah, I don't
there
know.
You lost me. You see, like they're my like my plain Jane brain where like poof.
There's so much. The thing is like again, one thing about writing this book, also I told myself this is like the first book of its kind, really. And so it doesn't have to do everything. Like other people are gonna write maybe I'll write some more books. So maybe some other people will write some more books. And like we're just getting started in a way. Like, don't worry. Don't try to do everything in this one book, right?
And I think it was very focused. Like, that part about we're talking about new thought is really more like planting the seeds so we understand, hey, this is a current. It's like the ocean. They come and back. This is, you know, you set for that the scene. And then you really understand how Hawaii was just one more practitioner in this sea of change, right?
Yeah, exactly. But she obviously she's a very influential, like,
yeah.
If we're talking about currents, like, I don't know what she's like a channel through which, you know, the ocean was flowing. She's like the Panama Canal or something. I don't know what she is, but like, she knows that like she's an important channel.
Yeah.
There is a lot of flow,
but
she's not the only, and now there's other lineages, you know, and yeah. And then also, I think even people from Takata's lineages are learning and maybe changing her practices a little bit, adapting things. I've seen, for example, people reciting her version of the Reiki ideals in, you know, prayer position, which is like the old thing that she took out, right? And so everyone's learning from each other, and yeah, it's really beautiful. But yeah, to talk about the precepts for a minute, I mean, this was known before. I think Frank Arjava Petter wrote about this. Franz Stina definitely wrote about this. And I think I really first saw it just on the internet, like maybe like James Deacon's website and Rick Rivard's website, which anyone learning about Reiki history back in like the 2000s might remember those websites. They were really important. And I don't know who found this first. It might have been Mochizuki Toshitaka. But the Bizan Suzuki stuff, the Suzuki Bizan, where the precepts that we receive from Usui Sensei are almost identical to this poem taught by this guy who is basically a Japanese Christian Science guy. And he said, you know, if you his version is just for today, don't anger, don't fear, right? It's a little different. Be honest. Right, a little different, but then work hard and be kind to people. And so, you know, and he published that, you know, a decade before Usui Sensei starts teaching. And so, and he studied Christian Science in America, and he was a philosophy professor, and he called his teaching health philosophy. And it was just like Christian Science, you know, you correct your mind, right? The problem is in your thinking. If you correct your mind, you'll be healthy, you'll be happy, you'll be wealthy, right? All the kind of health and wealth gospel kind of stuff.
I think the difference for me is like the mind in the Western is very rational. And in Japan, the mind, as you say, is the mind heart is a lot more. Sometimes, and I don't know about Christian Science, but when I think, for example, even though I grew up in Latin America, but I go to, you know, Descartes, like I'm born in Europe, like I think therefore I am. So for a lot of people, when you talk about mind, they don't understand it's this bigger consciousness mind versus just your regular mind.
I think it's interesting that when we're talking about, because their mind, right, they're not just talking about human mind, but also about divine mind. Yeah. And I guess the question is like, does divine reason follow the same like reason? Obviously, Descartes thought he was like kind of communing with God on some level, right?
Descartes screwed us.
Yeah, yeah. But like, and Spinoza too. But I wonder though, also like, you know, you think about like Kant or someone, right? Where the mind of God is really unknowable to our mind, right? Yeah. There's like a category difference there. And so is like the divine mind rational, or is it like transrational, or like, you know, and maybe like our reason is like limited. Again, these are very philosophical questions and you don't need to know the answer to do Reiki, right? I mean, these are,
yeah, this is just us for geeking out. But I think what we're trying to say is that, right? Like I say, and we mentioned that last interview, sometimes we're not Japanese and we're not Japanese in the 1920s. So our perception of Reiki, we always have to take with a grain of salt that we may be perceiving some elements differently. And for me, like, again, that's why, like, I also tell people to listen or to read people who have been analyzing this like you, or to even like go to Japanese tea ceremonies, like something truly not for tourists, to expose yourself a little bit to the culture, their Japanese societies, and get a little bit more, right?
Well, I think that's one of the things, like tea ceremony, I think is a great example because it really involves the kokoro.
Yeah.
Right? It's all about, and it says it's all about the kokoro, but it's not about rational thinking.
Nope.
Right. Pleasant. I mean, it's when you're learning the procedure, okay, now I turn the cup two times to rotate it, you know, 90 degrees. Then I take the cloth that I folded in this particular way and wipe it. But the idea is like that you do that so many times and you internalize those movements that you can do it like without thinking, right? And so there's this like Zen expression, I'm pretty sure you probably know, like munen muso, right?
With like, yeah, but you know the translation.
So it's without mind, without thought.
Yeah.
It's a different, it's not the same character, kokoro, but the nen is used in the gokai, not in the gokai itself, but in the after part where they say, keep these words, recite these words with your mouth and like basically like reflect on them in your kokoro. And it's kokoro ni nenji. Kokoro ni nenjiru, and is the same name also as nembutsu, the recitation practice.
Yeah, yeah, recitation of the Buddha, yeah.
With his name. And so nen is a kind of very like reflective mind or something like that. And so in Zen, they say you need to basically have like transcend that the mind, transcend thought. And that's when you're really able to see the true nature of reality. And that's also something that's said about Reiki practice, that like when you're really practicing, you're not thinking, you know, rational thoughts, and you've kind of cleared your mind, you've purified your mind in some sense, and you're able to receive, I think, that like divine mind or whatever you want to call it, that kind of
receive
Reiki from the universe, I mean, the universal mind, you know, that like, yes, it's not you doing it anymore. It's like this merging or dissolution into the universal mind or something like that.
I'm practicing sometimes with a Shin Buddhist priest, and he put it beautiful. He says, you can feel the universe working through you. And I found it so beautiful because it includes the body, right? And I think that is also part of their system. And we talked about that before. But I want to go a little bit to the gossipy part as well. Just, I'm joking.
Let's do it.
So for me, what I really impressed me, Hawaii Takata, first of all, she must have been quite smart and incredible people skills. She's born and she works at plantation as a kid. And, you know, that, again, socially at that time, it was even harder than now to move. And she ends up offering, and for those of people who love like gossip, like she actually offered a bunch of celebrities. I didn't know the Aldous Huxley, the wife of...
Aldous Huxley is... we don't know, have hard evidence. It's circumstantial evidence.
Yes. We don't have hard. I love your legal, but she literally like was moving into a Hollywood circle, rich people.
Elizabeth Taylor and Yeah, I mean, Doris Duke, I mean, Doris Duke people knew about, but I mean, she's the richest woman in the world next to Queen Elizabeth, I think, at the time. You know, I mean,
wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's very, and then Doris Duke obviously knew all these people. Yeah, so, I mean, it's pretty wild. But then also, backing up, like, she, 12 years old, is basically like, I'm not working on the plantation. And she starts getting, like, other jobs. You know, she ends up marrying this guy. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. And she's, like, working, like, three jobs at age 12 or something, right? And then she's marries this guy who's, like, you know, doing the, you know, he's, like, plantation accountant, bookkeeper. You know, he's, like, one of the top Nikkei people in all
so
of Hawaii.
She's marrying up already. Like, yeah, she's already married.
Has, like,
up.
Political appointments, you know, and then she's, like, working, you know, the political appointment system. She's, you know, getting money from this, like, very rich white plantation family for her to go to do the naturopathy school. I mean, like, talk about, like, social mobility. And then with a sixth grade education.
I know.
Right? I mean, yeah.
So for me, that was the part I really think people, like, are not aware of. Like, she really comes from humble beginnings, and she must have been extremely intelligent, extremely driven. And not only that, she also went through World War II. Again, she wasn't in a camp because Hawaii was, like, filled with Japanese. But I think also that explains, so often I say, like, oh, yeah, I've been told that she took the Japanese elements because she felt like white people would not get it. And I was like a little bit like, lady, I get you, but some of us will have gotten it. But actually, that's not really the real reason. They were putting all the Buddhist priests in camps. So can you tell a little bit about that? Because I think some people have been unfair from the Japanese lineage, like, about the way she did it. She had to do it.
Yeah. I mean, the question is, after the war, could she have gone back a little bit more Japanese? Like, that's the part where, like, I don't know what she was thinking. And also, there's a period where I don't have a ton of data from, like, 1950s, 1960s. There's, like, a bit of a gap. Like, I have a few data points in there, but, like, you know, is the question, could she have, like, re-Japanized some of the practices more after the war? I think she probably felt like she had changed the practices a bit, and she found it very effective, and yeah. She didn't see a need to go back. She thought she had improved the practice or something like that. But to back up, though, yeah. So up to 19... So it's so crazy. I don't make a big point of this in the book. I think I maybe briefly mention it, but she has this moving notice where she's moving into her new home and clinic in Hilo on the Big Island of Hawaii. And in a sense, she's made it. She's 40 years old, right? She's just turning 40. She has this big house with a clinic on the first floor. Her parents can live there. Her kids can live there. Her daughter, Alice, is about to start high school. Her mom and dad, she's taking care of them. They've been plantation laborers their whole lives, like, working so hard. And she's taking care of her family. She's got her professional practice. And she puts out this moving notice on December 7th, 1940. So it's 1 year to the day before the bombing of Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
And she's about to turn 40. And she tells everybody, hey, come on by. I'm doing my monthly, like, Kenkyukai, right? And so it's clear she's doing the Hayashi Reiki Kenkyukai the way that was being done in Japan, where once a month, all of the practitioners come, probably getting reiju at every meeting, right? Which is, like, the Japanese way. And you develop your skills, like, slowly under a teacher's supervision. And at the same time, though, she and Hayashi sensei were, and also maybe Usui sensei, Arjava also has found some evidence for this. And I think Olaf Bohm's book is coming out soon. I think he has some evidence in there for this. But there were maybe these, like, 5-day reiju kai in the Usui Reiki Ryoho Gakkai as well at that time. But so there were these, like, accelerated courses to advance more quickly, get a bunch of reiju 4 days or 5 days in a row, and then you're kind of get to that, you know, shoden level or something, you know, faster, maybe even okuden level faster,
and,
right?
And me just translate for, like, regular people.
Oh, sorry. Oh, yeah.
So what you're saying is basically at the moment, even though there was more a membership system versus a certification. So you will belong to the Brook and actually you will be a member and have to practice all the time. You didn't get a certificate that easily. They also were
or maybe you get the certificate. Maybe you get the certificate if you go to one of the 5-day like special meetings. But even with the certificate, that wasn't like, okay, now go into the world and you're a practitioner.
Yeah, it's a different kind of.
Yeah, it was more like, okay, you're a Reiki practitioner, practice, and keep coming to meetings because I want to see how you're doing and like feel your Reiki hands. And if you're really progressing, then maybe you're ready for next level, right?
Yeah.
And that's actually something where I think she did go back, because I think Hayashi, the evidence we have is that Hayashi was teaching Shoden Okuden, right? First degree, second degree in one class. And Takada, I think, stops doing that and is like, no, actually, you need to wait after you do Shoden, because you're maybe not be ready for Okuden. And she writes that in the 40s. There's different pieces of evidence where she says, you know, and then the students who are ready for it can take Okuden. And so I think that was part of these meetings, is the teacher is watching the progress of the students and kind of seeing, okay, who might be ready for the next class, right? So then during the war, though, they can't meet. It's those types of meetings, especially for something like spiritual, could be really dangerous. That, as you said already, the people who went to the camps were people like Buddhist priests, Shinto priests, of course, and also Japanese language teachers, people from the language schools. Because of things of like anything tied to Japanese culture, things that could be tied to nationalism, were seen as potentially dangerous by the U.S. government. And so she keeps teaching Reiki through the war, but it's, I think, more based on, first of all, people within the Japanese American community, not that many white students during the wartime. But when there were white students, it was people who she knew she could trust. And not just students, but patients as well. I found out, and it's in chapter 3, you know, that the she would get recommendations from like the Japanese Chamber of Commerce for like white people who you can trust. Like, you can give a treatment to this person and they won't turn you in or something. You know, I also found out a piece of evidence that I didn't put in the book, unfortunately. I think I either found out about it too late or I just kind of forgot to put it in. But there's a story from Phyllis Furumoto's brother that he shared about that there was something where like a case of Takada was going to go to a judge in Hilo, and the judge's wife was a Reiki either student or patient. And she said, no, you can't like prosecute her. You can't, you know, bring her to court, and the case was dropped or something like that. So like the like social networking and like the power of like knowing people and having like really changed people's lives, right? With treatments, with classes. And so she was able to like just fly enough under the radar, but at the same time, I think couldn't have like regular meetings of her group at her house. Like, that might have been too far, right? And so still teaching, still practicing, but like not so publicly. And also, of course, it's a famous example, the sign, right? It's like, I got to use the image in the book where they paint over the Japanese. They change the name, you know, they make it kind of seem more scientific, more, you know, massage and less Japanese, less spiritual, again, because like concerns maybe about.
And you can see how that actually still today, you know, it became more therapeutic, and we're going to go into her studies and everything else a little later. But I think for me, there were some things. First, when I saw, as you say, Hayashi teaching Reiki level 1 and 2 together, I'm like, okay, we cannot say anything to those people. Like, oh, you're teaching Reiki level 1 and 2 together. It was done. It was done over 5 days, though.
It was done doesn't mean it's a good idea.
Exactly. But it's funny. Like, I see what I want to say. We're always like, Western Reiki. Well, no. Like, there is no... It shouldn't be done on whatever lineage. It was already not, should not have done. But it was Hayashi, right? So
And the Yamaguchi lineage too. I mean, Chiyoko Yamaguchi is, she's the one who says that that's how she learned, was Shoden Okuden in 5 days. Yeah.
Because he used to teach like that when he traveled as well, especially when they travel and they left where they were based, Tokyo, whether I always forget where they are based.
Well, that's what she said. But then Takata did it at the Honbu, at the headquarters in Tokyo. Yeah. And she also seems to have gotten first degree, second degree back to back. So who knows? I mean, it's, again, that's something where, like, I'm not 100% sure. The dates on her certificates suggest that she did Shoden Okuden back to back. But again, I don't have the smoking gun, you know, diary entry or something like that. It's a little, the evidence suggests that she did Shoden Okuden back to back.
But there is also a little cultural difference, right? They had that membership program and they knew they had to practice, and Japanese people will take a skills, and culturally, you know, if you cut sushi, as you said, they practice, right?
We're not. And that's the thing, is he knew she was coming because she had been healed at the clinic, and he didn't want to take her on as the disciple or as a student. And then she was so serious about it. And so he taught her, but after teaching her, she was coming, working at the clinic every day, right? She was treating patients every day under his supervision. He was sending her out for house calls and then following up with the patients and seeing what her treatment was like, right? He was monitoring her progress very, very closely after that class. So it's not, again, it's not just like, he was like, okay, here's, you know, first degree, second degree, and go off into the world and do your thing. It was very much a very close teacher, student, master, disciple relationships.
I would love to see the face when, like, some days I tell my students after they finish, especially Reiki 2, which is, you know, may go professionally if they want to, like, please do at least ideally 50 hours of practice before, like, going professionally. Please at least minimum. And some people look at me like, why would I do that? I'm like, please do it, right? Like, because there is that part of practice. It is a practice. So and teachers will keep an eye on the students. Now with, I don't even remember the name of my first Reiki teacher, honestly. Like,
you know.
But now it's different. So the other thing I found fascinating, right? So she changes these, the work comes, and then she doesn't come back. But she also does this training, massage. She gets the money, all these trainings in Chicago, if I'm not wrong. And then I didn't know Reiki sessions. Like, she created the one-hour Reiki session.
I mean, it seems like that's the case. The early students of hers were treating for many hours. And in Hayashi's lineage in Japan, we also have documents that say treating for many hours, particularly for very serious cases. Like multiple people treating for hours at a time. And that was one of the things, that in chapter 3, where some of the Nikkei families from Hawaii were saying that their parents or their grandparents, you know, these early students of hers were critical that she changed that and said, you know, 1 hour and she's done. Like, what can you do in 1 hour? You know, like, and particularly if someone's very sick. And so that was a big, really interesting finding for me. But then again, she also did tell people, you want to treat 4 days in a row if you can, particularly if it's a chronic thing or someone who's seriously ill. So 1 hour, maybe she felt like that was enough for a day and that after an hour, you're not taking in that much. Or maybe she felt like people aren't going to pay for a 3 hour treatment. So, you know, just do an hour and then have them come back tomorrow. But maybe she also felt like instead of doing a 4 hour treatment, it actually works better. 1 hour one day, 1 hour the next day, 1 hour the next. You know, it's hard to say. I think that there's a combination in terms of she's a very practical woman. And so it's like thinking about like being a professional and like people maybe expect a kind of, if you have a, you know, fee for service practice, right? That there's going to be, a friend of mine coined this phrase, I think, the therapeutic hour. Right, where
that's the way you named it, and I loved it. Yeah,
that's my friend Peter in Kyoto, who writes also. He writes about shiatsu and other.
But if you think about it, and I don't even know if Ricky will have survived the other way, right? Like, if I call you as a practitioner, I have a busy life, and you tell me you come and you never know when you leave, I'll be like, you know. Or if you tell me, okay, Natalie, you're gonna be a Ricky practitioner, you go. Justin has a headache, you go until his headache goes. I don't know if I, like, but she also made it approachable for us, right?
Totally. And that's the professionalization of the practice I talk about, right? That, like, on like some Reiki practice is like a folk art, right? Where it's friends and family, it's, you know, people you love, it's your neighbor who has a problem, and you say, listen, there's this thing that I do, right? And then there's professional practice. And also, this is like one of the key things I think in my book is that, like you said, it wouldn't have become what it became if it wasn't for some of these changes. Because if you're a folk practitioner, great, but you're not going to spend your life, you're not going to dedicate your life to the practice. It's like something you do. And that's basically, I'm a folk practitioner, basically, right? Like, I mean, sure, like sometimes people pay me to give a talk or something, but like, I don't teach Reiki. I don't have a Reiki clinic. And I think most Reiki practitioners in the world are like folk practitioners. But if you're going to have people, but if you have people who are dedicating their life to teaching and treating, they have to get paid, right? I mean, like, and so this idea of like a vocation or a calling, right? Where there's like, on the one hand, there's a professional aspect to it, right? It's your occupation. And on the other hand, it's like your life work. It's your calling, you know, whether it's, you know, from above, depending on what you believe spiritually, religiously, you know, but some people really do feel like it's like a spiritual calling as well as a vocation, you know, in terms of a profession. And so I think that Takata, in a sense, made that possible.
I agree. And it's funny because understanding that is a therapeutic hour and professionalization for me, also for my Reiki One, gave me the permission to explain that. And at the beginning, you don't need to go the full hour, right? That's the professional. Like, some Reiki students at the beginning really struggle with giving treatments. So if they have lack of grounding or they feel drained, you don't, like, you can actually now say, "Huh, now I understand why is an hour is not needed. Just keep 15 minutes and build it up," right? So I think, and that's why I appreciate so much the books you write and, you know, also the other, like, people who write these books. When we understand the practice, we also understand how to support our students better, offer sessions better, right? It's not like it has to be an hour, because if not, it's not going to work. That's a standardization. That is the optimal in general for all of us. But it also helps us, like, if a student is struggling because they feel drained, we can tell them, hey, you don't need to give a full hour, right? Like, you can stop. You're just learning, like, you know. And if you did,
I think, I think, though, that, like, also the other thing from the Takata lineage that I think sometimes other lineages don't talk about that much is self-treatment, right? And like, there's a lot of criticism. Oh, you know, she doesn't teach Hatsudeiho and like this meditation practice. It's so important. But I think for Takata lineage, self-treatment is the Hatsudeiho. And if you're feeling drained, like, I think a lot of times if I hear that from a practitioner, I'm like, are you doing self-treatment regularly? And like, that's the other important thing that, like, I think Takata lineage really brings to the Reiki world is, hey, if you're doing an hour of self-Reiki a day, again, ideally, sometimes 10, 15 minutes is all you have, but ideally, you know, you have a practice, a self-treatment practice of an hour a day. I think a lot of those issues around like grounding or being drained
are gone
all the way. Yeah. Yeah.
Because you're bringing mind and body together, right? So for me also is, how do we do that hands-on healing? If you're doing it watching TV, it's good. It helps. But because, again, in Japanese practice, they're like, okay, I'm going to practice mind and body coming together. Not my mind is flying with it, like, somewhere else, and I place my hands in my body. Or, like, I've heard people like, oh, yeah, I do it when I sleep. Mm. I place my hands and I did my hour practice every night. But that's not what it meant. It really brings that. For me, hands-on healing is using the touch to bring mind and body together and be present in your body, right? And then it's grounding. And then you don't get drained. But most people at the beginning of their Reiki practice, the daily thing, they struggle with that, right?
Like, yeah. Well, I think it's one of the reasons why, like, meditation music, like New Age music, is so popular, is it gives you something to kind of come back to. You know, it's like a being present. But actually, a funny story, though, is that some of these Hilo area, like Nikkei practitioners who were critical of Takata for commercializing, they treated Reiki, some of them, not all, but some of them treated Reiki in a very social way. And so it's a bunch of Reiki ladies. It's like what we think of as Reiki share, getting together And not just for sharing on each other, but for treating people in the community who need Reiki. And so it's like two or three, four, you know, older ladies treating, and they're just talking the whole time. Like they're hanging out with each other, especially if you're treating for a long time. And so they're just like catching up, gossiping, whatever, with their hands on. And so, you know, I think on some level, sure, you know, non-duality, body, mind, you know, spirit, like union, and have this, you know, wonderful spiritual experience. But you, I think you can do Reiki while
you can, yeah. And especially when it's ours, right? Like And I'll use a more modest word because I don't think I'm a non-dual person most of the time, but stillness, I think also, again, you're talking Hawaii, in the 30s, 40s, people, they have a very still life. They didn't have the phone. Like now for me, like just doing this mindfully actually brings stillness. There is that limit of focus and ability we have to stay still. So yeah, if we had to give, there's also that beautiful interconnection of social you're bringing to chatter, right?
Yeah. And also a lot of these ladies are very devout, or all of them, I think, basically, are very devout Jodo Shinshu. So they know Nembutsu from when they're like little kids, right? Namu Amida Butsu, Namu Amida Butsu. So they can focus, be present. Like, I think that they have that bedrock foundation. So maybe it's easier for them to be talking, you know, with their friend while they're doing a treatment and also be very present at the same time. Like, maybe, I don't know. Yeah.
Maybe, or maybe not. But, you know, and again, if you have a 3-hour treatment, then you have moments of silence and conversation, but you're also probably being held by your community because they will treat people they know. So sometimes, honestly, like, if my friends place their hands on me, just the fact of being held by people, my community is already very healing, right? But when I think of self-practice, like if I'm watching, you know, Hunger Games and I'm placing my hands like this, and I've done it at one point, I've done everything wrong that can be done in Reiki almost. Yeah, you know, like, and people know that I'm not, yeah. I don't have to, I'm probably, the only mistake is I try not to be too fake. But you know, I did feel an effect. It wasn't bad, but sometimes I can feel the difference when I really practice, when I'm like holding, and I can feel all the crap moving inside me, all the anger, the fear of the day. And I just can hold the space for myself with my hands.
Yeah.
Then, and yeah, I can give 3 sessions and unless like I'm not going to feel drained, right? I'm actually like, it's the best day of my life. But that, as you say, has to do a little bit with practice, right? Being in our bodies and all of that. And I think Hawaii Takata knew intrinsically, we probably sometimes don't. And we're running out of time and I'm trying to be respectful.
Okay. Yeah.
But hold on, because I think the last thing I wanted to touch base, and there is so much more we could talk, and I really will refer people to read your book to know her whole story. One thing that surprised me, and that's because I had a friend who was obsessed with the Rosicrucians and the IAA. I didn't expect to see the Rosicrucians. They seem to appear in every historical thing I ever find about, you know. So for those people, again, I'll put a link to what they are, the Rosicrucians. I probably pronounced it wrong. So please check the notes of this podcast, I'll place, and all of it. Can you tell a little bit what they are and how did they show up in her life?
Well, that is so, yeah, you pronounce it right. I think both times you've been concerned about pronunciation, no problem. So Rosicrucians is actually a big category. It's not just the group that she was associated with, but it's basically these like fraternal order societies that have like esoteric aspects to them. And so sometimes you might call it like a secret society or something like that.
But they're European, right? Originally.
Well, it comes from Europe, and it's really a social group that has ritual practices. And I think they're feared because when like you can't tell the uninitiated what goes on in the group, right? Then that can be kind of scary. And think about like also people who are mistrustful of Reiki for the same reason, right? Why can't you tell us about, you know, the symbols or initiations? Oh, well, because you know, it wouldn't mean anything to you. It's not, you know, meaningful. Like it's only for the people who are at that level who are ready to receive those teachings or something. I mean, and so because these kind of like esoteric fraternal orders coming out of the European tradition and into North America and flourishing in North America, and these esoteric teachings coming out of India and flourishing in China and Japan, right? The esoteric Buddhism, right? And again, it's the same kind of logic of initiation and secret teachings that aren't for the uninitiated, and you move up through the ranks through like several different, you know. And so Takata, you know, whether for networking or whether because she's a spiritual seeker, gets involved with this group called AMORC, which is the Ancient Mystical Order of Rosicrucius or something like that. And it is an American, what they call like esoteric fraternal order. And you have to also remember in the early 20th century, I don't have the statistic at the top of my head. It's in chapter four. Something like half of Americans belonged to fraternal orders, right? Like this was like a very common, I think adult Americans. It was a very, very common thing. And it's a social group in a way. But the AMORC, right, it has these spiritual teachings. It's about perennialism, right? So that like all of the ancient wisdom traditions around the world kind of were intuiting aspects of like universal truth. And they had at the higher levels teachings about like healing vibrations and use some of the similar kind of language that she used about like radio waves or like, you know, that like healing vibrations are like radio waves. They permeate the universe. And if you can like attune yourself to them, you can cultivate these abilities and like very, very similar kinds of language. Some other things that she may have borrowed from them, like kind of in her language and her storytelling. But also you mentioned the IAA. So there's kind of like, I don't know if it's exactly like a Rosicrucian offshoot group, but it's like kind of like Rosicrucian affiliated fraternal order that has like Native American themes, or the Indian Association of America. And let me see if I could actually find the name of the church that they had. I have the book right here. Give me a sec. So it's the Indian Association of America and the American Indian Church Temple and Indian Missions in communion with ecumenical Eastern Orthodox churches. And that ecumenical Eastern Orthodox churches was like another esoteric fraternal order. It sounds like it's like Greek Orthodox, but it's not. It's a new Christian movement. And all of these movements, right, they love, you get different titles, you get different ranks, you get different certificates.
Grandmaster.
I mean, it's very much like these people who go around collecting certificates, you know, today, but, you know, 50, 70, 100 years ago. So it's from this group, Takata gets a certificate saying that she's a reverend, a minister, and another certificate that says that she's a doctor of naturopathy. And at a time when she's traveling around the US, right, she does this big teaching tour in 51. She gets these certificates in 48, and she carries them with her until the end of her life. And she carries, this is in chapter four, right? She carries these two cases. One case has her Reiki certificates from Hayashi Sensei. And one case has these certificates from the IAA and this Indian church, you know. And, you know, I think these Japanese language certificates might be helpful for some people. She could say, listen, this is my lineage. This is my Japanese background. For other people, right? Yeah, I'm a minister. I'm a doctor of naturopathy, right? And so they perform like different types of work. And I can imagine maybe got her out of some tight situations where the police were saying like, hey, we heard you're healing and teaching healing, but do you have a license for that? She's like, oh yes, you know, I'm a minister or I'm a doctor of naturopathy. And so having that affiliation with this organization, I think it seemed to have been important to her, right? She carried them with her. There's a photo that doesn't make it in the book, but I think I mentioned it. In 1979, she's teaching in Puerto Rico, and the newspaper runs a story about her. This is something she always did. She would always want the newspaper to run a story about her when she came. And they have a photograph of her, you know, 78 years old in San Juan, Puerto Rico, and she has these certificate cases open on the desk of the newspaper agency. And it's like, it's unbelievable. You know, 30 years later, after getting these certificates.
No,
obviously, it's important to her, yeah.
Like in Florida, you cannot, either you have to be a massage or a minister or a reverend. So it was quite smart of her. And I think that was my impression. I was very impressed how driven, how smart. And I said that at the beginning. But also, again, I think I see the human and I'm forever grateful for you for that. And we spoke almost an hour and we just created the surface of all the beautiful information of your book. We're not going to do it. They have to read the book because it's a fantastic, fantastic work. And I want everybody who's really understand, I think it's to understand the system and practice it with even more, I don't know, gusto. I just loved it to read that book. And you can see it's Monday night and I'm starting to be a little bit tired because my brain is starting to go everywhere. Justin, is there anything I may not have like highlighted from the book that you think like, hey, the reason you should get the book is like this great thing?
You know, I mean, it depends obviously what the reader is interested in. And you know, if you want more like little Reiki tidbits that are gonna, wow, I never knew, you know, there's a lot of that in the book. But I think, you know, I think the other thing, and but we talked about this the first time we talked, is again, I push back against this narrative that like Takata like westernized Reiki, right? And so, for example, she changes the five precepts to add this one about honor your parents, teachers, and elders. And again, it's like, oh, you know, she was trying to make herself this big authority figure. And, you know, she told her students never to question her. And, you know, I think there's a lot of people who are very like skeptical of Takata's motives and things like that. But I think, you know, my interpretation is that her students didn't understand what it's like to study a Japanese art, right? And so anyone who's done martial arts, anyone who's done tea ceremony, anyone who's done Ikebana, they know, don't ask your teacher a million questions. Just listen to what they tell you to do and try your best to do it. And they'll correct you, you know, maybe as you go on, if you're lucky. But just, you know, you have to listen to your teacher. And I think Takata was realizing her students didn't understand that, you know, who weren't trained in Japanese background. And so I think she changed the precepts, not to westernize them, but to actually to Japanize them for people without that Japanese training. And so I think that's one of the big arguments from the book that I think people from the Reiki community might be interested in that perspective. Yeah.
I really appreciate sharing that. I was at a martial arts seminar and there was this person questioning the sensei, and she's an American sensei, and two or three people questioned and they were pushy. And at the end she said, if I were a Japanese sensei, this will not fly. Like, you listen, like if you have a question, maybe, but like literally you listen and practice. And if you practice for years and you have a question, then you come. And I think is what you're saying. She was really trying to actually have people just practice and versus always be in your head and asking, you know?
And what's really interesting is she actually, when she was studying under Hayashi, there's a story in chapter 2 about this where they didn't want her to study because she was American. And she gets chewed out by this older lady who says, listen, if you have questions, ask me later. Don't ask them. Don't ask the sensei in front of everybody. That's not how we do it. And so she also, right, had to, even though she's Japanese American, had to get socialized into the Japanese way.
I love finding all about her. And again, she's a human, a very smart one, but she's not this mother saint, even though she feels grandma like our grandmother, she was a human, and that makes her.
And she's also not this arch villain. I mean, there are people out there with the Japanese lineages sometimes who are like blame Takata for everything wrong in the Reiki world, and it's like that's really not the case. Like,
well, also, she never told people sell an atunan for $40 and send a manual via email. She will have never, you know, it's
or do a weekend training where you become a grandmaster or whatever. You know, I mean, there's a lot of crazy stuff in the Reiki world that, yeah, definitely she did not put her stamp of approval.
Today she got a little bit of redemption. And I was thinking, if she's your great-great-grandmother, since I got an attunement, that means you and I are like cousins.
That's right. Well, that's definitely a thing about Reiki world. We all are related on some. I mean, obviously, we're human beings. We're related too. But with the Reiki connections and lineages, yeah, we all are one big Reiki family in some level.
Justin, thank you so much. And I'll be putting loads of notes and links with the interview, so people also like know where to find you. Also, perhaps links to some of the concepts. I may even do a little bit of a glossary, an easy one. I know some
are. I was realizing I'm saying Shoden and Okuden. I'm like, people may not know that's level one.
No, that's why I'm recording. So for the people listening to this end of the interview, you will get an intro that will be recorded after. So we'll put some of these terms, like what is reijo, the equivalent in English. But because I'm also trained Japanese, so I'm like, I get it and I get very excited. But I, again, you know, I know practice is very important, but sometimes we also need to have perspective on our practice. And this is a beautiful way of getting it. So Justin.
Yeah, well, Natalie, I love talking to you. You're one of my favorite people to talk to about this stuff. And I get excited too. And so I'm using terms that I know you know, and I'm like forgetting, okay, I don't know who's listening to this podcast. I don't know who your followers are. So obviously, like, yeah, thank you for doing some of that translation work for me.
They're used to me going crazy because I'm a nerd. I get very excited. I could talk to you the whole night. But I also think as practitioners, no matter your lineage, we have to get more familiar with the vocabulary that is closer to the origin. Because in those terms, actually, there is insight into our practice. So that's why I'm very happy. And that's why I also try to bring a wide range of voices. And because we need everything. It's a big diamond. We need every facet. So don't ever filter your Japanese names or any terms. I'll translate somehow. Don't worry.
I love it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Yeah, I know. It's always a real pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Dive into Reiki podcast. You can read a full transcript of today's interview at diveintoreiki.com/blog. If you found this episode helpful, please hit the subscribe button, leave me a review, or just share it with your friends. It makes all the difference. Thank you. Gracias. Merci.